I teach a continuing legal education and continuing psychological education seminars on this topic, and each of those seminars goes 8 hours, so the very short version of a lot of these notions. We're going to talk about problems with false memory, problems with leading and suggestive psychotherapy, problems with the mental health system that seems to ignore the science that is supposed to be the basis for the mental health system. But larger issues we're also going to discuss. One of them is, how do societies determine what is true and what is false? This is the central issue at the heart of the false memory syndrome question and problem. And I think what we're going to see is that the FMS issue is the tip of a much larger iceberg. Very serious problems in the mental health system in general. And I think what we're going to see is that in the States, and certainly in Canada also, one of the best ways to solve these problems, or to minimize these problems, has been to use the power of the legal system, which has been extremely successful. One of the things I'm here today to report to you is the great success we've had using the legal system to stop these problems. Let's start with a question. What are the two greatest achievements of civilization in the last 1,000 years? This is a particularly good year to ask this question. While you think about that for just a sec, I'd like to nominate two. One is a legal system that ensures individual liberty through a constitutional-based structure. And the other is science. That is a way of organizing and systematizing knowledge such that your knowledge is reliable and valid. But we can see throughout the world that individuals that live in societies that have this kind of legal system, and where that kind of legal system uses scientific information wisely, live lives that most other people who've lived in the last 1,000 years would be quite jealous of. And that individuals who live in societies that do not have such a legal system, or have a legal system that uses and abuses junk science, or invalid and unreliable information, those individuals can have lives that are very difficult indeed. Just in this century, just in the Soviet Union and in Nazi Germany and in Communist China and in other countries, we have seen what happens to the quality of life when individuals do not enjoy a legal system that protects their individual liberties and acts rationally, and a science system that's based on valid and reliable information. I'm often asked how these intelligent therapists, and some of them are fairly intelligent, but most of them are extremely ignorant. And I know because I've deposed, golly, maybe 30 of them at this point in our lawsuits. These are long, sometimes one full day, sometimes, I think Dr. Braun's case, 5 full days of asking them questions about what they know about science and psychology and psychiatry. And the level of ignorance of most of these therapists is really quite shocking. But we all know about a famous person named Aristotle, right? And Aristotle was a very intelligent and a very educated person. And Aristotle decided that he was going to try to understand why a rock accelerates when it's dropped from a high point. And Aristotle thought about this and thought about this and thought about this, and he came to a particular theory. You've probably heard it. Many of you heard this. That there are 4 elements to the universe, according to Aristotle, right? Earth, wind, fire, and water. And Aristotle's notion was that the rock is made of earth, and the earth is made of earth. And so the rock accelerates when you drop it, because it is happy and excited to be going home. This is not a theory that we think of as being particularly reliable and valid. It's an extremely important cautionary tale, because it shows us what happens when even the brightest of individuals begin to hypothesize without the rules and the methods of science. The greatest healers of the Middle Ages relied upon bleeding and leeching. as their primary way of treating individuals for virtually every illness they could possibly have. And this treatment continued, this pseudo-treatment, continued for centuries. Why? Because the healers were not intelligent? Of course not. Many of them were the brightest people in their culture. It continued for centuries because they did not know how to test whether the treatment was truly effective or not. They didn't know about treatment outcome research. They didn't know about placebo groups. They didn't know about statistics. And under those conditions, even the most intelligent of healers are likely to be led far astray from the truth. But they would say, my patients tell me that leeching helped them. They'd come in with a cold and a fever, and I'd bleed and leech them, and 3 weeks later, they'd be okay. Well, obviously, the bleeding and leeching worked, right? And the patient would report that it was helpful. This is the same kind of poor logic we see psychotherapists use every day, presently. So this question of how do we decide what is true and what is false, and how does society do that? And how is that truth or falsehood, how is that enforced by a legal system? Those are questions that we're going to be looking at. We have a lot of controversy about diagnosis. Someone being diagnosed as being abused in childhood because of certain symptoms, like a headache or trouble sleeping or trouble waking. Certain people being diagnosed as having a so-called multiple personality disorder, which is a pseudo-illness that we'll talk about later if we have time. But perhaps the greatest diagnostic issue of the last 1,000 years was who is or is not a witch. There was a large manual for diagnosing witches, kind of the DSM of the Middle Ages, that had scores of bizarre tests for who and who is not a witch. Let me give you one that was particularly hazardous. They would take the person, this could be men, women, children, even animals, and the poor person under study would be tied to a chair, as it says in the manual, with stout rope, in the middle of the town square in medieval Europe, in the summertime. And the theory was that witches could call to their aid imps that frequently took the form of flying insects. And so if a flying insect came and landed on the person under suspicion, it was, quote, proof, unquote, that they were a witch and they would be burned alive. This is not a diagnostic strategy that we would consider valid and reliable. But it did exist for hundreds of years, because after they burned the witch, then the rain would stop, or the rain would start, or any of these other pseudo pieces of evidence that were being used improperly to prove the truth of the theory. Again, in taking the depositions of therapists who implant false memories, we see over and over again these very same simple, basic errors of logic and methodology. The question is, how do we get a legal system to enforce individual liberties and protect individual liberties using real science, not junk science? You see, the most dangerous situation is when you have the legal system enforcing junk science. That's what happened in the witch trials. That's what happened in Nazi Germany. That's what happened in the Soviet Union. That's what's happened in many countries in the Western world where mental health expert testimony, falsely given and falsely conceived, has sent innocent people to prison. And the question is, how do we fix that system? And we're going to talk about that in some detail. One of the classic examples of pseudoscientific thinking is the work of Sigmund Freud. Now, when I went to school, I went to graduate school at Berkeley and Minnesota and Stanford, and we always referred to that person as Sigmund Freud. This was in the 70s. I mean, most scientifically oriented people have referred to him as Sigmund Freud since the 50s, I think. And yet it is unfortunately still the case that many, many psychotherapists base what they do on the pseudoscientific notions of Sigmund Freud, virtually all of which have been devastatingly disproven by research. Let me give you a really good example of the good science, bad science difference and how it works in the legal system. How many of you have heard of the Ray case in San Diego? Mr. Ray and his wife and his daughter lived in San Diego. And one night, a horrible crime took place. His young daughter was raped in her bedroom at night in the dark. She saw no one, there were no witnesses. As a result of the psychological trauma experienced by this child, she went into therapy. And she went into therapy with a woman who had not read any of the research on child trauma victims. Because the research on child trauma victims, as you probably all know, indicates that all the victims remember it very well. And they don't repress the memories, and they don't dissociate the memories. And that finding has been shown in studies of over 3,300 children known to have been sexually mistreated, and about 10,000 general trauma victims. But in this case, that therapist didn't know that research. What that therapist knew was works like The Courage to Heal, books that contain absolutely wild misinformation about human memory, about the impact of trauma. And this therapist began over a period of months to work with this young girl to help her recover the memory of what happened to her. And since the therapist believed that sex abuse was rampant in America and that it almost always was fathers of daughters, lo and behold, the daughter came to have a memory, quote unquote, of being abused by her father. And he was arrested, taken to prison, and was looking at a very lengthy prison sentence. Someone in the sheriff's department remembered that at the time of the crime they had collected evidence, which they had carefully bagged and preserved. And among that evidence was some DNA stains, which they tested and found that the odds were about 1 in 100 million that it was Mr. Ray who had perpetrated this crime, and he was released immediately. They then began to do DNA matchings on known sex offenders who had been arrested and or lived in that neighborhood, and they had a match within days. What would have happened to Mr. Ray if we didn't have DNA testing? What would have happened to Mr. Ray if the legal system hadn't admitted DNA testimony as science? That's another excellent cautionary tale of the difference and distinction between good science and bad science, and how it can have a real life impact on people's lives. So, the legal system in the United States is quite concerned with this, and over the last 70 years they've had various levels of methods to keep out junk science testimony. Starting in the 20s with the Fry Rule, which was, is it generally accepted in the relevant community? This keeps out a lot of junk science, but obviously in the question of repressed memories, it would let junk science in. If the judge thought that therapists doing therapy using hypnosis and other improper methods to recover memories, if they believed that was the relevant community, then experts would be able to testify about these dangerous ideas. But in the early 90s, the Supreme Court made a very large leap forward in the legal system. And legal commentators are just now beginning to see what an important case this was, because legal commentators don't know much about science. And lawyers are not trained to think like scientists, and this is a serious impediment to legal education that will need to be changed rather radically in the next generation. But in the Daubert case, or the Daubert case, for those who choose to speak French, in the Daubert case, the court said that expert testimony will not be permitted unless it meets certain minimal standards of reliability. Sounds reasonable. Do we want expert witnesses saying that someone's guilty because their crystal ball said so? Do we want someone testifying that someone's guilty because their Ouija board indicated that that was the case? Well, there are lots of mental health expert witnesses who testify as to inkblot tests and hypnotically recreated memories and feelings they have about parents being attached to their children, such evidence having no more reliability or validity than Ouija boards. We've had a lot of success getting the licenses of those people revoked recently. But in any event, in the Daubert ruling, the court said the theory has to be testable. I don't know how many of you have read the works of Karl Popper, but the works of Karl Popper and his philosophy of science is science, according to virtually all scientists that I know, is now the official law of the land in the United States, pretty much. Is the theory testable? Has it been tested? Has it been published in reputable peer-reviewed journals subject to criticism? Is it generally accepted in the relevant scientific community? And what's the error rate? What's the percentage or probability that you're making a mistake when you use this method? This is a tremendous protection for citizens against junk science in the legal system. This ruling has just been dramatically expanded in the last few weeks by the U.S. Supreme Court in a decision written by Justice Breyer, which I've been waiting for 6 years, because when I studied with Justice Breyer at Harvard, he talked about doing this. And it is basically expanding those rules not only to scientific experts, but to all experts, including clinical experts, including therapist experts. I can't tell you how unhappy this makes the defendants in our lawsuits, because we've been able to convince each and every single court that we've ever tried that repression is junk science, and their experts can't talk about it in court. Now we begin to see how the use of a legal system with good science, with reliable science, is a tremendous protection to the rights of citizens. We just won a hearing about 2 weeks ago in Rhode Island. Hopefully the last criminal case in the United States where an individual was tried for a crime based on nothing more than the recovered memories of a mental patient. And in that hearing, which went on for a month and involved national experts on all sides, the judge ruled, as they have in every other case in which we've done this, that repression is not generally accepted by the relevant scientific community, that it is not. That it has not been shown to be a reliable and valid theory, and the experts may not testify that it is. And you can imagine that those criminal cases disappear very rapidly at that point. Okay, so we talked about the Frye standard and the Daubert standard. The most recent version is the Kumho standard, and that applies to all witnesses. This is a major sea change in the legal system. For many years, experts could testify to any wacky theory they liked. And especially in the mental health field, this has been very troublesome, especially to children in family court, where therapists would use all kinds of bizarre test procedures and assessment devices and have them draw pictures and all kinds of crazy, unreliable things, and then courts would act on that. Well, that's about to end now, because lawyers are beginning to read the science books. They're beginning to learn the methodology of science. They're going to learn how to ask questions of expert witnesses. And I assure you, having asked questions all over America of these expert, so-called experts on repression and whatnot, they don't have answers to these questions. And the research that they cite is so shot full of holes that judges find them humorous. This is a great thing about the legal system, because you really get to go through that research piece by piece and show the judge or the jury that the evidence that they claim supports the theory of repression is simply junk science. Now think about the long-term implications of this for the mental health system. There are laws in many states that if you have an illness, the healthcare provider must give you a reasonable treatment. Well, what's a reasonable treatment? A reasonable treatment is a treatment that's proven reliable and effective by scientific means. Well, there goes 50% of the treatments offered in the mental health system. Does that make sense? This has huge implications that many people are just now waking up to. If the law, for example, permits taxpayer dollars to be spent on mental health treatments, and the law states that the treatments have to be proven safe and effective, or they have to meet minimal standards of reliability, well, that's going to straighten out the mental health system in a rather dramatic way. Because some of these therapists will continue to do this treatment, even if they're not paid for it, but most of them won't. Most of the difficulty involved in the mental health system has been the enormous increase in its size, that is, the number of therapists doubling almost every 6 years since the 1960s. The enormous number of dollars poured into it, now estimated at $60 billion a year in the United States, and the almost total lack of regulation over what is called, quote, psychotherapy, unquote, such that if people can get taxpayer dollars to do group therapy for individuals who claim to be abducted by aliens, or abused in past lives, or abused in utero, or abused when they're 2 years old and recovered the memories under hypnosis, or whatever junk science theory appears to be current, then those therapies are going to grow. They're going to be financially fed at the taxpayer trough, and that's not appropriate. And that's what we're trying to stop legislatively, and we'll talk about that later. And most of the junk science ideas, if you trace them back, they all go right back to Dr. Freud. So we've had this long stream of these junk science theories. False memory induction is just the latest and the most severe of a long stream that goes all the way back to lobotomies and Rolfing and primal screaming. I don't know if you've heard about that wonderful treatment. And reparenting therapy, where you make someone a baby and then you reparent them in therapy, which is very time-consuming and expensive. Gestalt treatments, where you had people scream in an empty chair. Catharsis treatments, where you had people beating pillows with tennis rackets to alleviate their anger. People are doing this. I still depose witnesses who have their patients do these things. And why in the world insurance companies continue to pay for it is something we can also address legislatively, because stockholder suits might be an excellent way to stop that. How about the theory that mothers were responsible for their children's autism? That was Bruno Bettelheim's brilliant idea that made thousands of mothers feel horrifically guilty over nothing. It was a totally bogus theory to blame a mother for their child's neurological deficit. Cruel. How about the notion of facilitated communication, where autistic children will type out messages with the aid of a helper who would help them point to the keys? And lo and behold, the messages pointed out are always the ones that the helper wants to get out. And the helpers were taught that child abuse is rampant. So the autistic kids started typing out child abuse messages. And this went on for years until someone at Harvard Med School devised a study that a freshman in psychology would have done before using this test. They would show children, the autistic children, a picture. Then they would show the facilitator a picture. And during the transfer, the picture would change. No one would know that it would change. The child would see a picture of a spoon, the facilitator would see a picture of, let's say, a car, and then they put them together, and guess what? Guess what the messages always were in each and every case? The picture seen by the facilitator. Now, if lawyers had understood science and had a question, reliability and validity, that stuff would never have survived even a week. And under Daubert and Daubert, and under Kumho, that kind of test will not survive a week in the U.S. legal system now, if the judges and lawyers are doing their job. How about hypnosis to recover memories? I can't tell you how many of these therapists tell me in the depositions, well, no one knew about false memories until the 90s, when that group in Philadelphia started warning everyone. And then we begin to bring out the research from the 60s and the 70s and the warning from the AMA in 1985. And my favorite is the Encyclopedia Britannica in 1974. an article by Martin Oren that details how you can create delusional beliefs and false memories using hypnosis. 74. And they're, of course, they're stunned. But how could anyone be experimenting on human beings in this manner and being paid for it with taxpayer dollars without knowing this most basic information? It's shocking. And how could they not be sued for it? Well, let's talk about that. Oh, but first I've got a few more on my list of bad junk science things happening in the mental health system. How about anatomical doll interviews? How many hundreds of people were sentenced to prison based on anatomical doll interviews, where you interview a child with these dolls that have actually enlarged anatomical parts? And no one did any research to see what these dolls would do to normal children. And when the research was done, it indicated that about 50% of normal children may accuse someone of felony sex abuse just because of the suggestive nature of these dolls. And I can tell you right now that when judges find out that research and they have sentenced people to prison based on this, they are very upset. Judges are very upset when they feel like they've been hoodwinked by mental health experts, and many judges are learning that they have been. Okay, memory recovery therapy. Where did this come from? We have decades of research on children and adults who experience trauma. Holocaust victims. Victims of the Cambodian concentration camps. I've talked to probably 100 victims of the Cambodian concentration camps myself, young and old. Nobody forgot it. Nobody dissociated the memory of being in those camps. The same is true for Holocaust victims. The same is true for victims of plane crashes and earthquakes and tornadoes and wars and floods and rapes and famines and child abuse. The purpose of our nervous system is to remember dangerous things to avoid them. That's why we have a nervous system. It's one of the major reasons. Of all the millions of children abused in China and other large countries, they don't even have a word for repressed memories. The concept is a bizarre notion. And the research clearly indicates that there is no evidence for it. And that's why courts over and over and over again throw it out. What kind of research do they argue supports repression? I'll give you an example. We're in this hearing in a criminal court case on the East Coast. And the repressed memory expert gets up and cites the Dollinger case as evidence of repression. Now again, if there's no one in the room that actually has that study and who's read it, he'd get away with that, right? And that's how business as usual was done in the legal system until recently. But you know what? We had that study in the courtroom. And it turns out to be a study of a bunch of kids who were playing soccer, and three of them were struck by lightning. And three of them were knocked unconscious. And one of them died. And the ones that were knocked unconscious don't remember being knocked unconscious. And the one that died did not recover any memories. And yet all three of them are listed in this research study as evidence of repression. And experts get away with this? They've been getting away with it for too long. By the way, all the other kids on the soccer field remembered really well their friends being struck by lightning, even though it was a horrifying thing to see. Okay, so enter the legal system. We have a legal system that's supposed to help regulate these kinds of problems. But let's look at medicine. Most medical historians think that medicine started assisting people as much as injuring them sometime around 1910. And that was when medicine started relying upon science. And medical school training after the Flexner Report radically changed. Huge numbers of medical schools went bankrupt. It used to be that people who were doing herb therapies and chiropractors and surgeons at Harvard Med School were equally powerful and considered equally useful in the medical system. Well, that changed. And we started using physics like x-rays, and we started using bacteriology and And all these basic sciences began to be used in medicine, and medicine got very good at what it does. Very good. So good that junk science theories, like mental health theories, could tag along on their respectability. And that's what's happened. But even in the medical system, there weren't any really any malpractice suits until the 1940s and 50s, when some medical doctors went to law school. People who knew the lingo, people who knew how to read a chart, people who knew what was supposed to happen and what was not supposed to happen. But not in the mental health system. No lawsuits there. Oh, sure, someone could be sued for sex with a patient or for not confining someone who committed suicide or homicide. But the idea of a lawsuit for improper practice of psychotherapy was considered impossible well into the 90s. So we have a system essentially not being regulated. We have a ball game with no referees. And the most troubling aspect of this is that we know that a lot of disturbed people go into the mental health field. And we know that the regulation of the field, its self-regulation is extremely weak, because you have individuals doing therapy in a closed room, one therapist and one disturbed patient. And sometimes you have two disturbed people in that room. And you don't have anyone watching like you do in a surgical theater, where if the surgeon behaves very strangely, people notice right away. And this can go on for years in the mental health system. I mean, some of these therapists were inducing these horrible memories in their patients over a period of years. And no one was following up, and no one was catching this. And no one stopped them when they said things like the CIA and the International Satanic Cult are brainwashing governors of states. And these clearly delusional beliefs didn't raise an eyebrow in these hospitals. These practices went on until the lawsuits stopped them. So what happened was, I'll give you the short history of the legal efforts to change the mental health system. The first famous case was the Osheroff versus Chestnut Lodge. Dr. Osheroff suffered from depression, looked like basic biological depression. He went to Chestnut Lodge, which was a psychoanalytic institute. They didn't believe in medication. So for 7 or 8 months, this poor man was tortured with chit-chat about his family when he was suicidally depressed. He finally escaped, got into psychopharmacology treatments, and was fine within months. He decided to sue. There was a great deal of anxiety about that lawsuit by the psychotherapy community, because they realized that a lot of what they do hasn't been proven safe and effective by anybody. And in fact, the research indicates it's probably no better than chit-chatting with just about anybody else. That case was settled quietly, secretly, confidentially, and had virtually no impact on the legal system. And then we don't see anything until the 90s, until the Ramona case, in the early 90s. And that was a very difficult case to win. It was very well tried. And it involved a new concept, a multidisciplinary legal team. Mr. Harrington had Harrison Pope of Harvard Medical School to assist him with all the science parts of that case. And they won that case, although it was not a financial victory because of the huge expenses in the case. And the jury verdict wasn't as high as lawyers need to make it economically viable. So again, the system really didn't change very much. Well, then we have a series of cases against a Dr. Humanansky in Minnesota. I don't know if you've heard of these. I'm very familiar with those. I participated in those cases. The first jury verdict against Dr. Humanansky for implanting false memories using improper leading and suggestive psychotherapy rather than cognitive behavior therapy, which had been proven safe and effective for the women's depression. The jury verdict was $2.67 million. And all of a sudden, lawyers were interested in the psychotherapy negligence lawsuit business. Then there were other suits in Chicago and Texas. Zach Bravos and Skip Simpson and Larkin Aiken and others were settling suits. And these were secret and confidential, but people were at least aware that these suits were moving forward and that they were being relatively successful. So now we have dozens of these suits beginning. And we have therapists starting to fall all over themselves to change what they do. Well, I stopped doing hypnosis. Well, when did you stop doing that? 1996. Well, when did you close down your hospital unit for MPD treatment? 1996. Well, when did you leave Texas and move to the other state, 1996? When did you voluntarily give up your license, 1996? I mean, I just can't tell you how cowardly I hear this. I will start saying the date for them before they finish. So obviously, lawsuits have a huge effect. Right after the second Humanansky jury verdict, I gave a talk to 1,000 doctors in San Francisco at the North American Postgraduate Medical Meetings. And afterwards, hospital administrators, surgeons, physicians came up and said, we like those jury verdicts. Because finally now in our board meetings, we were able to get rid of these wacky mental health programs. We had a financial reason to do so. And we stopped them all immediately. One guy said, we began to see every MPD patient as a walking $2 million invoice. Okay. So the legal system can have effects. It can change things. What is truly appalling is that the mental health system went so long without this kind of regulation and got itself into so many blind alleys and so many pseudoscientific theories. Everything from projective testing to primal screaming and rolfing and anatomical doll interviews and dream analysis and spending years talking to people about what their infancy was like when you know that people can't remember their infancy. And all the other things that have gone on for most of the last century, which are now coming to an end because of the power of the legal system. The other thing that's meshed in here is the rise of managed care, HMOs and managed care. They're interested, they're actually interested in whether treatments work, in whether they're cost effective, in whether they're efficient, in whether there's research to show that the treatment is safe and effective. Because they have a fiduciary responsibility to make sure that the treatments they offer are effective and also cost effective. And this is having a dramatic change on the mental health system. And the lawsuits and the managed care revolution is really eliminating a lot of these old problems in the mental health system. And you see fewer and fewer therapists doing these kinds of things. What still remains to happen, though, is for insurance companies to actually start looking at the files as to what goes on in therapy. Because we also see in our lawsuits lots of therapists who got insurance money because they kept telling the insurance company they were just doing work for depression when they were actually helping the patient recover memories of being the high priestess in the International Satanic Cult. We see a lot of that. In fact, in one case, the insurance company paid $3 million in treatment for a family with the most bizarre therapy imaginable. A 10-minute review of those records would have stopped those payments, but in $3 million, the insurance company never sent anyone to look. Okay, briefly, people often ask, why do therapists do this? And the basic reason is they're ignorant. They are not well trained. They don't know how to think like scientists. They don't read the research in their own field. They don't even know the journals in their own field. They don't have to. They won't get sued. They don't care. My friends who are surgeons, if they miss their most recent surgical journal, they're in a panic. They will go to the library if it doesn't show up in their mailbox. They want to read the most recent version. Therapists, and I see Dr. X, when was the last time you read this journal? I think it was in graduate school. And so that would have been 25 years ago, correct? Yes, that's correct. I mean, how did this get so far off center? How did the mental health system get so far removed from the rest of the healthcare system and yet still be funded by the same kind of funding as the rest of the healthcare system? These are things that are changing. Oh yes, how about multiple personality disorder? I can tell you I've talked to dozens and dozens and dozens of multiple personality disorder individuals. At least that's what their record said. And I had a chance as a lawyer doing their suits to review their case in detail and to talk to their high school teachers and to look at their elementary and pediatric and high school records. And you know what? I've never seen any evidence of any one of these people having an alter before they met the therapist. And the question I ask over and over again, you know, if we've got 50 alters, I'll ask it 50 times. Let's say the alter is Susie and Dr. X, do you have any evidence of any sort, of any kind, from any time, that patient Y ever believed she had the alter Susie living in her body, that she'd ever believed such a thing before she met you? And you know what? They never have an answer to that. And I've looked at their high school records, and many of these people were brilliant. It didn't say, well, she got an A in history, but you know, this alter Susie came out during the exam, and we had to send her to the counselor's office. Nothing like that, ever. Never anything like that at all. Why do the patients stay in the system? That's the easiest question of all. When you have surgery, they do bad things to you. They cut you open. Why do you do that? Why do you let someone cut you open? Because you trust the doctor. Because you want to get well. Because you're not an expert in surgery. And that's exactly why patients stay in treatment. When you have cancer treatment, why do you let them give you these horrible drugs that make you feel so awful for months and lose your hair? Because you want to get well. Because you're told that's the only way you'll get well, and because you're told you'll die if you don't. And that's exactly why these patients stay in this treatment. They don't think they have a choice other than dying. And the MPD therapists are real clear that they'll stay MPD and probably kill themselves unless they submit to endless sessions of hypnosis and or Amytal and or leading and suggestive questions and or mapping alters and all the other crazy things that they do. All right, so how do we change the system? We've talked about the power of the legal system. Education is important. Obviously, this organization and the False Memory Syndrome Foundation in the United States have done an amazing job of educating not just the public, but they're also educating their professions and they're educating the judges, and I can tell you they're educating juries. And this kind of education is very, very important. It certainly helped educate the media, and the media have been very helpful in getting out the word on this form of quackery. I also like to ask therapists, what's your definition of the word quack? And they'll say something like, well, a treatment that doesn't have any evidence that it works. I see. And can you cite for me any peer-reviewed scientific evidence that your treatment works? No. And did you inform the patient that you were engaged in quackery with them? Well, it's true, right? The truth hurts. These people have been experimenting on human beings without their permission, without informed consent, without a scintilla of scientific evidence that what they do is worth anything. And they have been billing insurance companies and taking public funds for this for years, and no one stopped it until recently. And what stopped it was people like you. Because you see, the mental health system was too small and unimportant and too kind of bizarre for the legal system to deal with. It was flying under the radar of the legal system for many, many years, until the recovered memory therapists started getting their patients to accuse prominent family members and respectable citizens of heinous crimes and to get them prosecuted for it. So now the legal system gets involved, and once they got the legal system involved, the end was guaranteed. They doomed themselves when they started testifying in courtrooms about repressed memories and sending people to prison. They doomed themselves because it was only a matter of time before the legal system would find out the truth. As slow as it is a very good system of grinding out the truth. All right, so education is critically important and will continue to be important. But let's not fool ourselves that these therapists, most of them are going to change just because we're educating them. Most of these people were taught the correct way to think and to read research in graduate school. They ignored it. Many of these people were trained at good institutions by good people who are horrified at what they're now doing. They go to some seminar in Chicago and learn crazy ways of mistreating people, and then they apply that to their patients and they forget everything they learned in their graduate and medical programs. So education has its limits. regulation, that is licensing boards. We've been very successful at getting the licenses revoked of a lot of these therapists. But in many other states, the boards are so lenient and so lax, they're almost worthless. Because the boards, of course, are populated by members of that profession. It's what we call a captured industry board. It's captured by the very industry they're supposed to regulate. I served on the state board in Minnesota. They're wonderful people. They did probably more active than any board that I know of, but it was difficult for them to really enforce the rules in a way that would stop most of these mistreatments from taking place. And also, they were backed up for years. They didn't have the funding and the staffing to do the job that was necessary. The third way is litigation. We've talked about that. I think I've been involved in close to 50 of these lawsuits now. We've won about 98% of them. They're very effective. They're very, very effective. And we've never lost a Daubert hearing, that is excluding repression, as a subject of expert witness testimony. So the legal system in this area is very efficient. And the last way to solve this problem is legislation. We have a law that we have proposed called the Truth and Responsibility in Mental Health Practices Act. And I tell legislatures, well, which part don't you like, the truth or the responsibility? And basically, all that it does is it requires three things. One, that patients be fairly and reasonably and truthfully informed about the risks and benefits of the treatment they're being offered and alternative treatments. That's already the ethics rule for mental health professionals. It is uniformly ignored. Juries will enforce it. But we need to make sure that there's legislation to enforce it. The second part is even more powerful, and it is that no taxpayer or taxpayer-exempt dollars shall be used for any form of mental health treatment unless it is proven safe and effective by reliable scientific means. Now, how hard is that? And again, people would say, oh, well, what is science, and we can't agree on what science is. Oh, no, we all agree on what science is now because the Supreme Court says what science is. And judges don't have any problem enforcing this at all, so I'm sure legislators and licensing boards shouldn't either. Science is not a fluffy concept. It should be quite clear what that means in the legal system. And then three, expert witnesses must state the limitations on their methods and conclusions to the court. Can you imagine how different that would be? Well, and expert X, who's the best parent for this child? Well, Your Honor, research shows that the secretary in our department and the cab driver outside and your clerk are no better at making that judgment than I am. That would change things, wouldn't it? Or, well, Your Honor, I use this ink blot test, even though the research shows that it's bogus and it's not worth anything. And I use this draw person test, even though the research shows that national experts cannot distinguish between psychotic inpatients and normal children using this test. That would change things. Those are the questions I ask the experts if they're in the courtroom and they use one of these things. And it's very humiliating, and the judges get furious at these people because they've been duped for years by these experts using these quack treatments and quack tests and quack methods. So those are the three components of the Truth and Responsibility in Mental Health Practices Act. Informed consent, no money unless there's some evidence that it's an effective treatment, and three, experts must state limitations. You would think the professional associations would support such a reasonable measure, wouldn't you? They're spending millions of dollars to fight it. And we have gotten a part of it passed in the state of Indiana. In fact, it passed unanimously. And my guess is that no one could vote against this in public. If they kill the law, it's always in the dark of night and the third committee down, and there's some money that's changing hands probably. But in any event, the legislation will probably come last because we just don't have time right now. Many of us who would testify at these hearings are so busy in these lawsuits, and the lawsuits are working so very well. I took the deposition of Dr. Colin Ross this week in a lawsuit, And I asked him how many of these MPD clinics had been closed down in the last few years, like since 1996, and he went on a very long list. These lawsuits are working. And he explained to us how he doesn't do these things anymore. And he doesn't do that anymore. And he doesn't do that anymore. And he doesn't do this anymore. And he's really careful to hire people who don't ask leading and suggestive questions. And we're all very much aware now of the suggestibility false memory problem, thanks to that group in Philadelphia. But that doesn't mean that the problem is over. Because look at the strength of these quack treatments, from lobotomies to primal screaming to rolfing to reparenting to dream analysis to recovered memory therapy to MPD alter mapping. I mean, where is it going to end? There's going to be another one of these, and then another one, and then another one, and then another one until the money plug is pulled. And that's why the need to get the insurance companies and the government funding agencies involved in taking some responsibility for making sure that they're not paying for treatments that are injuring citizens, because that's what's been happening. The most responsible governmental act that I know of in this regard is that the state of Washington had a victims compensation fund. They would pay victims of violent crimes. And they were paying out huge amounts of money to recovered memory victims. And a study came out looking at about 30 or 33 of these victims. And in each and every case, what had happened to them in so-called therapy was horrifying. They'd gone from being working taxpaying citizen to being unemployable. They'd gone from married to divorce. They'd gone from reasonably normal to horribly depressed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And on the basis of those data, the state of Washington cut it off. They said, we're not paying for this anymore. That's what we need. That's a sensible solution. And doing the research is not that difficult. Just like doing treatment outcome research, it's not that difficult. You have a placebo group, treatment A, treatment B, you do tests, you follow people up, and you see who gets better and who doesn't. It's not difficult. We do have excellent treatments in the mental health system for depression and anxiety. Cognitive behavior therapy is a good example of that. The difference? They look at the present and the future. They don't look at the past. They teach people skills that they can use to control their own behavior and their own moods. They don't make the person dependent on a therapist. Major, major philosophical change. You must remember that many of the theories upon which a lot of psychotherapies are based were created by people like Freud, who were rabid atheists and didn't believe in free will and had ideas that are completely antithetical to the basic fundamental philosophical foundations of Western civilization. So it shouldn't be a surprise that people would get worse if they're taught such beliefs and ideas. Think about really what a false memory therapist is teaching their patient. They're teaching them they have no free will. They're teaching them that something that may or happened to them 40 years ago is controlling their life on a day-to-day basis today. They're teaching them to hate their family. They're teaching them to turn away from anyone who doesn't buy this new theory of their life. This isn't just bad science, it's evil. And how it could go on so long being so clearly evil is something that we're all going to have to ponder, those of us who try to think what the mental health system should look like sometime in the future. We do have all this great research too on how people cope with stress. Norman Garmazy and all these wonderful people spent their life studying individuals who experienced tremendous pressure and stress and coped with it very well. The vast majority of children who are actually abused do very well psychologically. The majority of children in the concentration camps do very well. How do they do that? What are they doing? They're relying upon social support systems like their family. They have very solid beliefs in their free will, their moral agency, their ability to control their thoughts and feelings. They focus on positive things in the future and goals. They do all the things that these therapists pull away from people. And the future mental health system will be based upon the psychology of copers and coping. and it will not be based on the pseudoscientific nonsense of Sigmund Freud. So we've come a long way in our talk about repression and repressed memories. I used to do a lot of research with children who suffered from extreme handicaps. And what I learned from them was that from every bad thing in your life, every stressful thing, there are things that are positive. And so I'd like to encourage you, I know a lot of you have had a great deal of difficulty with this problem. Many of your families have been badly damaged. But I want you to know, because you don't hear it from people like I do every day, I want you to know how grateful people are for what you've done to get the word out, to warn the citizens, to be the Paul Revere, to ride through the night and warn of the evil influence of this kind of therapy and the damage that it can do to people. And it has saved a lot of people's lives. And it has, a lot of patients who formerly believed these memories have listened to this and thought about it and realized what happened to them. And those people are very, very grateful to you. I'm grateful for the opportunity to participate in hopefully reshaping the mental health system in a way that's meaningful, in a way that's going to help people. And I'm grateful for the wonderful people that I've met doing this work. I went to law school to write legislation. I didn't go to law school to sue people. When my faculty member friends at medical schools called me and said, what are we going to do about this? That's when we started thinking that we needed to sue some people. The history of civilizations is littered with the remains of societies that failed to carefully distinguish between truth and falsehood. Let us be careful how we make that distinction. Let us be careful how our legal system uses scientific information. Let us be careful how we protect the liberties of citizens and make sure that we are relying upon valid and reliable knowledge and information. We've been given a duty to preserve a moral civilization that we live in, that a lot of our ancestors and relatives have fought very hard for. We owe it to our children and to their children to maintain this system and to vigorously guard against junk science ideas from wherever they may come, including the mental health system. It is my hope and prayer that we may do our duty to guard and to defend for our children and for their posterity the freedom and liberty with which we have been so richly blessed. Thank you.